Helps to switch it on, doesn't it? This morning the theme is community. I'll speak in a general and specific way about this, of the indispensable, that means the essential importance of it. Cannot be overemphasized. So from the general for a few moments to the specifics, and while speaking to you, the focus and priority is, if I may say, for you yourselves, and then the value of community and the development of it with regard to those that you may be working with, teaching with, and so forth. Let me just go to the general. Human beings, it's often said and repeatedly said, we are social creatures. It is no wonder that for men, women, and children at home with the lockdown, it has contributed to an immense amount of pressure at home for families, for couples, for singles. And the recognition of our interrelationship and interconnection is vital, and you and I find ourselves, in a way, in a variety of small communities. It needs the recognition of them and the challenges. The first obvious one is called the family. That means close relatives and distant relatives who share something either by relationship, by marriage, by the network, parents, kids, grandparents, brothers, sisters, uncles and aunts, cousins, and so forth. It may be in this particular network, this particular community of people, there is either some distance from or some issue or problem with. It's very easy to put the responsibility, all of it, on the other. If only she, he, they were different. This is not in the field of the exploration of mindfulness. Sometimes we want other people to be different so that we feel okay. You'd be lucky. So it's worthwhile giving some reflection. What will contribute from yourselves, from myself and my family, contribute to the developing of this small community, which goes under the general name the family? And our actions, our words, our support, empathy, and love, we trust in that. It doesn't mean to say it will have any impact on the person who is withdrawn from the family, nor on anybody who has any anger or issues with oneself or the family. But mindfulness is to keep faith and trust with deep values. Second area of community, for those of you who are working, will be those that you work with, from the bosses to those who in the lowest paid, to the part-timers and full-timers, whether you work at home or whether you go to a building. And there are those who can't work at home, engaged in public service, engaged in the necessities of being with others, and so forth. They're also part of a community, and we can spend much time in this area of community. What's the support that we give? There are other areas of common interest. The area of common interest may show itself in sports, hobbies, creativity, spirituality, religion, and much, much more. Again, it's a relationship. That relationship will quite often challenge us, and we explore our practice to see what is wise and skillful in the communication with others within these families or within these networks there. There is sometimes an idea, there's no truth in it, but it's a common one in our kind of circles. That means mindfulness, meditation, spirituality, yoga, and much, much more. There is a common idea that you have to do it by yourself. Nobody can do it for you. And therefore, the truth is within you. No truth in that. What else do we tell ourselves? But it gives a residue of impression that it's all about ourself. And this contraction, it's said regularly. And when that happens, people really think their practice is all about themselves. And when that happens, with the priority, we are forgetting the indispensable, essential area of community. That means the contact and the company with the like-minded. So, having spent more years on this earth than most of you, I'm going to use this for some authority here. Yeah. Having spent entire life involved in religion, backstroke, spirituality, and with countless numbers of blessings, with meeting some really wonderful and precious human beings who have given their life to these areas that you and I have been touching over the past year, I have not yet met a single person who has done everything by themselves and alone. Not one in a lifetime of this. So that surely has to be saying something. And what I mean by that is the regularity of initiative and making contact with others. Others could be those who are on the same journey. Others could be with a role, teachers, leaders, authority figures, facilitators, therapists, meditation teachers, and more. And that regularity of that contact gives us nourishment. We can discover things and realize things which we hadn't seen nor understood before. And it only shows, as social beings, it is just as important in the area of mindfulness, meditation, ethics, inquiry, heart opening, as it is in working with same people in the same factory, the same shop, the same office, or whatever, or with the family who require extra attention, and usually more than for other families. The same principle is working there. So if we have the idea, if I meditate at home regularly, which is lovely and beautiful, and then, and I just do my mindfulness practice, and then I just go to work or study or look after the kids, that would be enough. That's a chance. Don't carry the thought like this. Because we need, shall we call it, the family of practitioners. They are as important, maybe even more important, than the biological family. So the encouragement, both for each of you this morning and in the role as a mindfulness teacher, is to develop that kindness and friendship and mutual support and togetherness, and really give that a priority. Please do not leave people with the impression that it's all about their practice, that's all that matters. Doesn't work like that. The interconnectedness is an ingredient. I'll just take actually from the out of the Buddhist tradition, because I've heard this a few times over the years. So some time ago I referred to this sense of community, spiritual friendship. In the Christian church it would be called the congregation. In the Buddhist tradition it would be called the Sangha, which literally means gathering. And emphasize the precious value of it. And then a person said, yes, but the Buddha, who established a Sangha, a congregation, made a comment to be a light unto oneself. Take refuge, that's the word he used, in oneself. There. So it would sound like, oh, that's what we do. We just look to ourselves. We don't look outwardly. We just look within. And if we look within, that's what we need to do. And then from that, everything will come. But there was a context of what is said. And what the context is, if you, yes, you, and others, if we find ourselves living and facing very difficult people, aggressive, blaming, abusive, negative, or just withdrawn and cut us off, whatever it might be, in such a circumstance where we're in a situation where we've got nobody to turn to, nobody. It does happen, not very often, but it happens. Then we take refuge in ourselves. Then, okay, I'm isolated, I'm in prison, it's so aggressive, I'm in a very challenging and isolated situation. My family doesn't understand me, they're constantly attacking me and blaming me. In such a situation, one takes refuge in oneself. One just tries to find that peace within. Fortunately, that is unusual. But it will require, quite often, us to reach out and develop this. And I'd just like to, not only for ourselves, in fact, but also in connection and cooperation with others. So one of the first questions you could ask yourself on the value and importance of this is, what steps do I take to have contact with the like-minded? you very kindly have committed yourself to the year. All these group meetings, the small group meetings, the Zoom meditations together, there's been a lot of togetherness. And the one-to-ones with the teachers, the sharing of those 250 words in the month that you would send us, and much, much more, is part of the collective supporting and cooperating with each other, and all of us alike learn a lot out of this, out of the collective. And as we know, the learning out of this collective has been genuinely beneficial, and it might be right through the whole life, in a way that if we hadn't had this year together, things might be looking very, very differently. So we take the experience of the benefit there, even though it's not easy, even though you've made lots of acts of renunciation, you've dropped other things to ensure you could be present, you've explored mindfulness and much, much more. And now the question is, we are in the very last days, it's Saturday, and tomorrow is Sunday. It always has been. And in coming to the close there, the core message is, right, this is finished. It arose, it stayed for a year, and now it is finished. Not entirely, I'll speak to you about that in a little while. So what's going to cultivate the network? I hope that plenty of you, I'll write to you all about this as well, will keep connected with each other. It could be a lot of you, it could be a small number of you, it could be two of you, it doesn't matter. But somebody more than yourself. And that kind of sharing, and we've made it clear until the cows come home, we've made it clear. It's not a sect. It's not a closed group. To me, that's the polar opposite of what freedom is all about. Any closed group holding to that, it's not liberating, it's unhealthy. So we've had a group together for the year, and we wish to encourage not to stay within this group, but to explore ways to reach out whereby you initiate sanghas, you initiate congregations, you initiate small groups, you initiate networks, communities, whatever language you feel comfortable with there. And that's going to take some activity. And it will take quite a lot of additional activity to nourish it and keep it going. And your precious role in this. So if I just take myself for a moment, if I may. Everybody starts off in a very small and modest way. To give an example, I remember years ago, there's a lovely part of England, between Wales and England, in fact, called the Wye Valley. And there was an invitation to give a retreat in a scouts hall, actually, up in the hills. And the decision to do it was an extended one, which was for 14 days. So I had a manager, myself, I think Christina Feldman, I think she was teaching with me, remember, at that time. Now, the number of bookings for it was 6. So 2 teachers, 6 people registered. This is probably around the late 1970s. So a few voices around, friends, said, "Oh, Christa, 14 days and only 6 people have registered. You know, let's cancel it and try again later or next year or whatever." And I said, no. That's the number that's registered. And we did the 14-day retreat. Actually, I still remember the weather was quite lovely. But out of the 14 days, one became a Dharma teacher some years later, had a very deep time, beautiful experience there. Another one became a major organizer for us. And sometimes it's in the small, I mean, this is 6 in this case, that a depth goes which may have had, we don't know, far more long-term impact than if 20 or 30 had come and had a nice retreat. In other words, you and I, we don't know the impact that we have. Sometimes we never see it, we never hear it, but we do it. We offer. So that outreach from you, and particularly the idea which I kind of warm to very much with this, is for yourselves to reflect and have a good look at all the knowledge, experience and understanding that you have. And that could be in a whole variety of ways of life. And then the question might come, is there a way, having reflected on my life, looked at the skills I've got that may be learnt in university, I didn't go to university, but probably some of you did, or at college, I also didn't go to college either, or it might just be life experiences in relationships, in parenting, in travelling, in being in the nature, being on retreats, and much, much more. And say, is there a way I can be a small bridge in which I can draw on this wealth of experience in this area or areas, link it to mindfulness, and from the mindfulness and the experience and the knowledge, link it to the support for others who would be interested in that which I have had a lot of interest in over the years. And therefore you act as a facilitator as much as a teacher, drawing on your wealth of experience to offer to others. And then, of course, comes the question that goes with it, what is a useful and creative way to do it? And we need a kind of being humble with this. It's sometimes very small steps. So, again, because it's easier to remember from personal examples. I moved to Totnes, which is where I live. And this was around 40 years ago. 1981, I think, 1982. And initially that's Gwenwyn, the partner at the time, and my daughter, who was a few months old, and myself. And I put up a few small posters in the town, small pieces in the health food shop, in the bookshop, so forth, because we didn't know anybody, and offered the mindfulness meditation practice from 10 till 4 on a donation in the living room of where we lived, just on the edge of the town. So around, and that was for the Saturday and the Sunday, people could come both days or one day, and ask people to bring some food with them for the lunch and share the food. So around 12 people came. One of the 12 people knew a man named Maurice Ash. He was owner of a huge estate, huge mansion there. The outcome of that was we set up a community. We had 20, 25 years of programs, workshops going on there, and they were able to live there for free. He's a very kind and generous man in this huge mansion there. So once again, just to repeat the story, we connect, we make friends, and there's something precious about the informality. We are not professionals. We are not amateurs. We're not in those secular boxes. So probability is you wouldn't dream of going for a coffee, if the coffee shops were open, so it might be outside now, with your therapist, with your doctor, with your dentist, with your counsellor or whatever. It's a professional arrangement, a precise amount of time with. But you have the privilege and the opportunity, and those that you have contact with, you can meet informally. We're not tied down to a strict role. And quite often I find some really long-standing friendships develop. And people want to support what we do because we've made a good contact with the person. So appreciate the form and be very mindful and respectful to the form. It's really, really precious and important, and to your role and to your authority. But equally as well, recognizing times and opportunities for the informality, the coffee, taking of a walk. And that friendship and authority, it's not easy, can really work together very well. And people find that they wish to give support, and the network of you grows, and quite a few of us can only, maybe all of us in fact, can only do what we do because of people giving support. Retreat centres, managers, organisers, people who help to put programmes together, people who do flyers and posters and much, 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 much more. So you take your authority from your past, you take your authority from your present, you find ways to do that, and for the majority of people that I know, it's often a kind of working together. Now what I mean by that is, as we say in English, you still do your regular day job, and one might cultivate the mindfulness classes or mindfulness workshop or whatever. And what a few people that I know do, as that begins to develop, which is a lot of work, a lot of dedication to serve others, the response comes in. Financial support comes in. You either set the prices or on donation, whichever you feel is best for you. And as that develops more, the day job might gradually go down if you can. It might go from 5 days a week to 4 days a week, if it's possible there. And gradually, sense of being a full-time teacher comes in. It's a gradual, for those who wish, shift over. And plenty others just for years offer some teachings and practices in the role of the teacher and have the financial stability and security, or the staying with the job that which they love, and they stay with that and this extra of as the mindfulness teacher. All of that in your good consideration. There's no right or wrong or better or worse or whatever. You can hold the two roles together. That means your regular day role, and the mindfulness teacher may have the view of gradually, as your network begins to grow, move shift over, or you just find the balance which works for you. All is available. We put finally at the I think it was in the PDF sent to you, because of the fluid and flexible nature of the course, I put in some timetables and some different kinds of courses. That kind of form and structure is available. You may wish to use it or some of it and do that. So that more or less covers what I wanted to say. I've got my head down here. I'm just trying to think if anything missed out. Now I think I've covered the various threads and themes with the nourishment of community life, connected life. Is this something fairly regular? It might be on Zoom, of course, and I have found, and the response and feedback in the emails from quite a few of you is, to our surprise, you know, in a way, Zoom works quite well. One of the benefits, and one of the most common, is that people have really a real sense of their mindfulness practice is really taking place right in their home. We would love it to be residential. We'd love to see you in a residential retreat. Of course we would. But if that can't happen, at least we can sit, walk, stand, recline, do our practices indoors at home or in the area around us. Let's just have a quiet minute and then we'll have the question period. So, any questions? Should I ask, would you like me to switch the recorder off? My editing skills are not brilliant in terms of people taking, including and excluding and so forth. So, if you don't want it on, just let me know and I'll put it into the pause mode. All right? So, any area, not only with the talking with you this morning, but anything else. We've got around 45 minutes or so. And past means over the year, present, future.
Yes.
Okay. yes, please.
I sometimes am thinking about creating a group or something and yes. Teaching people how to do mindfulness practice, but I'm a bit scared because I think it's such a big thing, really, and I don't know where to start, and there's so many, from my experience, you can do it wrong as well. So, because when I started meditating, I didn't know anything about it, and I was just doing it, I think, to avoid real life, really. So, and all these things could happen, and only when I heard about dukkha and all these things, and pleasure and pain and gain and loss and all these things, then I did understand a bit more, and then it really worked for me with the Buddhist theory, really. And before that it was just like avoiding real life. So I'm a bit scared that I can't teach it in the right way, and that people don't benefit.
The preparation to ensure the benefit, one is the very essential practices. So let's say, quite a lot of people are clearly interested in reducing the stress and pressure in their life. And they really want some tools, they may want some helpful tips as well. So it's genuinely based on experience. So, for example, you brought together five people. They could be friends, or a friend and a stranger, or whatever. And then it's a period, say, an hour or an hour and a half together. And with that, using the language of, say, reduction of stress, being more relaxed, feeling the present more. This is supportive. It's not avoiding real life. It's actually experiencing it in a different way. So you just sit together. It could be in chairs. You don't need to use any Buddhist language like dukkha or anything like that. Doesn't have to be spoken at all. And so there's just a brief introduction, you know, people coming. You might just introduce yourselves. A little bit of perhaps a sentence or two about the motivation. You might just say yourself, I've just completed a year's training through Zoom on mindfulness teaching. And then say, we're going to begin this evening with 15 minutes of mindfulness of breath. And you give those instructions. And you might say, we'll do circle walking around the chairs if there's enough space. Just very slow, mindful there. And you explain the benefit of slowing down, feeling your body, feeling yourself walking, feeling the body breathing there. And then from that, some sharing together. And asking people just to keep as much as they can with their experience. And then you just quietly respond to that. Plenty of appreciation for the sharing. If a person is very quiet, she or he doesn't say anything, sometimes, and often in fact, people wait to be asked. Some people are not comfortable in kind of speaking up first. So you look and it might be one or two people who are sitting there very quiet, don't have the confidence. Very common this, to speak even in front of a group of five or six. So you just turn to the person and ask a good specific question. Anything which you found challenging when you were sitting? Mm-hmm. What did when you were doing the walking around in the circle together? There anything you appreciated? Things like that. So the question you ask is concrete enough that their mind can go straight to their experience. There's nothing theoretical at all there. And then you might still got some time, say, let's just have another 10-minute, 15-minute sitting together. Having shared, let's do it again. And then you might again ask to share there. Sometimes you can ask people to be in a group of, to form into groups of two, and then they share together their experience. Often they share quite a lot together because it's just two. They're more comfortable with two than with six. So, and then at the end, over the hour, hour and a half or whatever, you just have a quiet period together with them. You just go over the practices that you did. You give some general encouragement for the daily life. And if it's a course, you'll tell them a little bit of just a few sentences about something extra you will do next week, whatever that might be. So they've got something to look forward to. And you send them an email which gives a summary of what you did that evening. And then do that, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. That's and you can say, I'm just beginning, and people usually are very appreciative to hear that. They say, oh yeah, this person is just beginning and going to be a little bit nervous, and it's going to be the first time. But confidence grows quite quickly. So that's my suggestion. Any questions? No? All good? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Kira, I just want to encourage you. You have such an open and style to invite people and talk about yourself so openly. So it's so easy to connect to you. And I found it fascinating. So if I were you, I wouldn't worry at all about coming people together and share about their struggles.
Yes.
Because you're so open and you invite people to do the same.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, it's a very good point there. That what's lovely with, especially with these mindfulness practices, it's being open to experience. We don't have to have any knowledge of philosophy or psychology or Buddhism or whatever. We might have, but we don't have to have. We look at the human experience. We look at what contributes to happiness, peace of mind and clarity. Open to others and in communication and what we can offer to others, etc. So our priority is the experience of the other and ourselves and the interconnectedness. Yeah. And I see again and again, and as you just pointed out, some people are, you know, precious beings, very warm, very, very open there. But there's just some shyness or lack of confidence or something else that just needs to come so that the openness and the warmth is kept, it's not closed off, and the voice comes through as well. And that's the skill. And in a world where we really need each other, and where where it's really precious to feel listened to and heard. The mindfulness teachings can offer a great deal. It's different from religion and work, where it's often very much around either beliefs or doing, but not really about experience. And we have experience as our priority. Yeah. And yourself with roles and openness and reaching out, any response for yourself? What's your response? Any in fact, anyone here, this is the question. Yes.
I'd like to share.
Yes, please.
On the theme as well that you brought up of community and teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Two things. One, before I got so much into mindfulness and Buddhism, I spent a period of my life training in some Shaolin Kung Fu.
Shaolin Kung Fu. Oh yes, yes, right, right, yes. The Chinese monks. Yes. I missed that.
You're muted, so I can't hear you.
Am I? Oh, how did that happen? All right, all good. Okay, sorry. So you did Shaolin and Kung Fu. Nice, good one.
And one of the things that was nice, the teacher was an Israeli teacher, but he had spent 6 years training in China.
Uh-huh.
He was quite close. And the teaching was in nature. There was no classroom. It was under a tree. Uh-huh. And there were no levels. There was not an advanced class and a beginner's class.
Yes.
Everyone learned together, and at different periods of the class, he would ask the more advanced students to take beginner students and to work with them.
Mm.
And it was really beautiful. Like for me, it was like eye opening. I have never experienced a learning environment that was so open and free, and it wasn't structured and divided amongst ability or level. Even though we were doing some, like, I didn't get that far, but some people there were doing crazy things. Yeah, it's I don't know if you know this world. And this reminds me, I've thought quite a bit about, there is in the beginning of the Anapanasati Sutra, mm-hmm. which is one of my favorites, there is a whole part that is often skipped that is talking about when the Buddha arrives and he sees monks and they're teaching each other. Yeah, and there's some monks that are teaching 10 people, and some monks that are teaching 20, and some that are teaching 30. And he is really happy, and then he said he's going to stay for a whole month just because of this, and he asked them to practice even more. And I've just found in my experience that there is this flow between me being a part of a community as a student and being a part of a community as a teacher, or being a part of a community that is just a sharing sangha where there is no hierarchy at all, and how much support flows between them.
Mm.
Like how much I get from assuming the role, either any role, right? And transitioning between them, and how much confidence. And it goes in waves. Yes, it's like when I first started teaching, then I felt I didn't know anything, and then I had to learn, and then I felt like I knew more, so then I could teach again, and it's like moving around like that. And I just wanted to share about that, because yeah. I feel like sometimes I'm doing the teaching more to give, and sometimes I'm doing it more to receive. And vice versa, and it's all very, like, the Sangha is all very interconnected in that way.
Yeah. If I could just mirror and reflect a little on the good points that you made. The early ones were a very good reminder. So sometimes there is a kind of hierarchy of authority. So one has whatever it might be, the teacher, and then the seniors, and those who have less experience, and those who are very, very new. And this model is a regular one, it's a frequent one. Start off in business, and you work in the office, and then gradually become a manager, and up the ladder you go. But it's not the only model, and we just heard a really good one there, in which the general consensus is support. So this is somewhat inspired, as you point out, by the Buddha. In fact, the word teacher was usually only, he was the only one who was referred to as teacher, because he was the founder. But more importantly, this friendship and connection in which people can offer and share, can lead and facilitate, and there is a network of contact and closeness. And the recognition, and it was like this in the monastery when I was a monk, one just went, one got to know monks in various ways, and there was the opportunity just to meet together. And they weren't the teacher, but they were kind of teaching. You know, just learning from them. And that exploration of expansive view, learning from each other, and to know each other and share and see, whoa, I could learn this from this person and from that person, and small groups. So it's much less hierarchical, but it's not swinging to the other extreme and saying, oh, we're all equal, we're all the same. We're not. There are people who do know more than we do and have more understanding than we do and more insights than we do. Okay, let's listen. Let's learn. And there will be areas where we have some good understanding about whatever it might be. Okay, let's share. And it's this is more important, a kind of middle way between hierarchy on the one side and sameness on the other. And if we can just bear a few of these things in mind, it will also help. And again, the adaptability of mindfulness, you know, it's precious. So you saw with the Sholin and these tremendously mindful movements and the kind of authority and power and courage too, actually, that they engage in. It's one way that the mindfulness has been adapted. It's still got its same roots in ethics, cooperation and sangha, simplicity of lifestyle, supporting each other, you know, physically, emotionally, and mentally. And that's what we're engaged in. What ways can we make that happen in our own society, in our own town, in our own workplace? We in terms of human contact and communication and cooperation, frankly, we're at kindergarten stage. The potential for this, you know, one of my, it's a good job you don't live in Totnes, you hear my rants about these things. The isolation of people and then the lockdown, wow. Instead of having neighborhood people in a street really caring for each other, with the strict disciplines of the face masks, etc., there, and really looking after each other, having friends and working with, and really seeing, is there anything you need? What support can we give each other? What a difference that would have made to people's lives. instead of saying you can't go out. You can easily knock on the door in the neighborhood scheme, still the social, and just checking the family, checking the kids. What way can we support each other? What a difference. No. It's stay indoors, don't you go out when it's when for whatever. The whole we need community. Community can work with these dramatic situations. And we've got to be really imaginative what community means. All right. Anyone else? Any responses, by the way? To yourself or anyone? Yes, anyone? Voice is still around?
Yes.
Good. Okay, go on.
I just need to adjust volume, I think. I just wanted to add to Kira and Urs, because I'm not the most open person and also not very extrovert. And I still had this experience where I started teaching some yoga a few years ago.
Yes.
Because I did a training on that. Mm. And then I just felt like it aligns. You know, I just felt like I was in the teaching role and I wasn't even feeling myself so much anymore.
Mm.
Because I was just sharing. And I really feel like so something aligns really in that situation. And I was, I really believe that the good intention is enough for the teaching. And you know, maybe you find some people that you know or maybe don't know, or you know, but people are really happy that they finally took the time for themselves and, you know, to take care of themselves, to do some mindfulness and even really simple practices. They have such great benefit.
Mm.
So I wouldn't have known that for myself, like this, like feeling actually fine in the role if I hadn't tried it. But it's really the big step to try it, to just do it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very good.
That's it. Just that what I wanted to share.
Yes. See, if I may respond, the attitude, the response is important. Some and plenty of people, it's the wish and the attitude to share. Something has been of benefit and one is just sharing. And that would include some instructions, but there's a feeling of just sharing. And there is no wish to step into the role of being the teacher with a capital T. And no, to be the authority. Some people's mode of being is kindness, empathy, softness there. The person then may say that. They don't want to be a yoga teacher, a mindfulness teacher. But the person enjoys the sharing. So that also can be stated. So some people come and they say, I'm not here as a yoga teacher, as a mindfulness teacher. Just wish to share and let's share together, and I'll just give a few guidelines and instructions, things like that. And people quite often respond very, very well to that approach. Some have a little suspicious about ego with authority. Who is she to tell me what to do? Who does he think he is? Etc. But the sharing, empathy, tone of voice and language makes it easier to hear. So we're still doing exactly as the yoga teacher might do, the meditation might do, but we're kind of coming from another place inside of us. And both are equally important. And just see, so some people have authority, step into the role quite fully, doesn't have to be any ego, and that's their voice. Another, it's a sharing voice. It's softer. Usually it's softer. So, currently for you, are you listening there? Did the yoga offering or sharing, did that continue for you? And did it continue for you? With the yoga?
No, no, it didn't. No. I decided I wanted to do something less. I mean, you can do yoga in a more subtler way, but it's not usually why people come to yoga classes. But I wanted to do something more awareness.
Yes.
More.
All right. Yes.
Living in. And, yeah.
Yeah. Lovely. So, you know, it's a kind of yoga. You know, meaning. Connectedness, it's a different kind of connectedness. You know, lots of similarities, and there's quite a lot of integration of the two. So a good friend of mine, he was going to a yoga class, and I said, this is in Vienna, and I said to him, how long have you been going to yoga class? He said, on average, around once a week for 12 years. And I went, well, I said, why do you go? You must know the asanas incredibly well. Why do you go? He said, one is for the community, together doing our yoga together. But he said, that's not the main reason. The main reason is, at the end of the yoga class, the yoga teacher, who's done lots of mindfulness practice, lots of meditation practices. The yoga teacher speaks for about 5 or 10 minutes about the values of ethics, mindfulness, meditation, spirituality, karma yoga, and much more. He said, I go really to listen to her speak just for a few minutes at the end. That nourishment nourishes me for the whole week. So I heard this 20 years ago. Since then, I thought, that's just brilliant. I found it really inspiring. I have been telling yoga teachers this for years. You finish the asanas, you finish the class, prepare something for 5 minutes of what really will be valuable for them in their daily life. Like that, yeah. And I spoke at, at a large yoga centre in London, actually the biggest one in the country, there, just on this theme. Yoga is inviting people to experience, to be in insight. It's a wonderful tradition there, and the two can work together.
Yeah, and it's usually what motivates you for doing yoga also, the physical one.
Yes.
It gives you a different kind of motivation, and I think it's great to bring it together.
Exactly. Yeah, they're very much of the same family, yoga and meditation. And Patanjali's sutra, gosh, it's so many passages are so parallel to Dharma teachings, meditation, mindfulness teachings. There's a lot of synchronicity between the two. Good. All right, thank you. Yes, anyone, please.
Yeah, I thought I wanted to share something too.
Yes, please.
I reflected on the role of, or on teachers and past teachers I had, like for my reflections yesterday. And I found it so interesting because I just wrote down like teachers in my life and like teachers that were in the role of the teacher, actually, because like every human I meet can be a teacher of mine, right? But just writing down all the teachers and then seeing all these different areas of mindfulness and yoga and academics and horses and whatever. And then I thought about what did they do similar? Like what was it that made them good teachers for me? And I found two things, like one, and that is also something I try to remind myself of when I teach, is to be, to some extent, sure about what I am doing. Not about everything that what I'm saying is right or the only right thing, but that something about what I'm sharing is important, and having trust in that. And that's what all teachers had in their areas, that they were passionate about it and somewhat steady in what they were doing, but at the same time not being too rigid with that, and also always having the will to learn themselves and to reflect and to get better. And like these two was what I was, okay, that I think that is what makes a good teacher.
Yeah.
Or that was what I thought yesterday. And yeah, that's, I try to think about that when I think now about me doing a mindfulness course.
Nice, yeah. Good points. The passion is another word for love. Whether there's much appreciation, the wish to share, there is the passion, the love will come through. And people will realize that this person loves this. This teacher loves what she's doing, loves what he is doing. And that's just as important as the methods, the techniques, and what we say. And also there is a real sense of, with the authority of the teacher, that there is still a learning process going on as well. And that's the humility of the teacher, that we always have much to learn. It's an eternal, in a way, learning process. And this meeting together, authority, learning, knowing one's subject matter with the love, heart and mind really work together with the role. But it's a lovely reflection that you did, and a good example of reflecting on the variety of teachers in that function there, seeing, and it's all the deep is always this, it's seeing what's in common. What do these teachers have in common? And then two or three things might really stand out. Ah, may I find that which is in common. When people look to me, they say, ah, this is what this teacher is offering. We learn sometimes with the teachers I have had, this is from my monk's days, sometimes I can actually hear their voice. They've said something to me, and it's been beautiful, and I've meditated and reflected on it, and then shared it. And your good teachers from the past will be the support. You know, in the traditions of the East, they're referred to as the gods and the goddesses. We need our gods and goddesses who inform us, to give us support to be fine teachers. And it's a really, really precious reflection that you did. Yeah, it's a good one. Yes, anyone, please. So far, I forgot to ask. It's all being recorded, but... Anyone, yes.
I asked this Ula yesterday, and I would just be interested in also your take on that.
Mm-hmm.
I've been thinking, talking, reading about cultural appropriation and mindfulness, or yoga especially, and I'm wondering what you think about this, and what are your thoughts about that?
Explain the term cultural appropriation. Say a little bit about this.
Sorry. when... It's a hard term to just explain, but I think when cultural practices and culture from the Global South especially, or other areas, get used in the West, or get westernized, basically, and then, it's just a Western thing, and then, for example, people in the West benefit very much from that, mm-hmm. but not in a respectful way. So there's different ways to handle that, and there's also different takes on the concept of cultural appropriation. And sometimes I'm like, is it okay that I want to teach mindfulness, but I don't really know a lot about Buddhism, for example? And questions like that.
Yeah. It's a genuinely an area for some reflection. So what I mean by that, there are a few approaches that can be made. For some, the value of the mindfulness is in the experience, in the exploration, in the teaching, sharing, and developing that. It is an offshoot of a very large tradition. Yoga is an offshoot of a very large tradition. So it's primarily known, yoga is primarily known for mind-body benefits through the use of forms, asanas, there. But yoga is karma yoga, yoga of service. Jnana yoga, of knowledge, of knowing. Dhyana yoga, of meditation. Bhakti yoga, of being devoted to that which is important. Tantra yoga, in terms of relationships and communication in relationships. So yoga belongs to a much bigger tradition. We the West here, and in the East too for that matter, appropriate and highlight one aspect. To me, it's fine. I'm quite comfortable personally with that. Plenty of my Dharma teachers never make any reference to the East, rarely use the word Dharma, hardly ever mention the Buddha, etc. Their voice is a voice which is connecting and appealing to those who just want to hear about practice and not necessarily draw upon a 2,500-year-old tradition. To me, that's absolutely fine. There are others who genuinely have an interest in the background, in the exploration of Dharma in a very large field. And the Buddhist tradition does give some support to that. So on this particular area, you've got to listen to yourself. That's the priority. So cultural appropriation of the specific, might call mindfulness, we might call it yoga classes or whatever, really can really work well. That's what people come for. It's really beneficial. For some, there is a spark to saying, well, is there more to mindfulness? What goes with it? What's the background to it? And that invites another inquiry. Person doing yoga says, yes, I'm really feeling the benefits of these yoga classes, but is there a bigger picture of yoga? There absolutely is. I just referred to it. So it is that kind of meeting. Stay fine and to stay steady with what one knows, what one offers and experiences, such as mindfulness. And some will explore and draw upon more. Both is fine in my regard, my view of things. You know, I'm just on the personal, once again, I'm a Dharma teacher. And so Dharma teacher is working with dependent arising, working with a pretty large vision of things with a wide number of engagements. And one of those primary and important functions with all that is being the mindfulness teacher. And the mindfulness teacher working with these specifics that we've been sharing together. So sometimes there's a fusion of the two. That's the case in the monastic system as well. There is a cultural appropriation in the monastery of Vipassana meditation. It was drawing a specific out of the tradition and emphasizing it and highlighting it. There's a cultural appropriation of the forest monks and nuns tradition, living in the forest, an utterly austere and simple life. There is an appropriation out of the larger tradition. So that is taking place east and west. Okay, thank you.
Now, Christopher, a yes. Follow-up question on the connection between mindfulness and Dharma teaching.
Yeah.
Also a question I asked yesterday.
Yeah, all right.
glad to get your perspective. So, I sometimes feel that now I can see much more clearly the limits of the teaching of mindfulness as opposed to the learning the broader teaching.
Yes.
And I wonder how much it took me a few years to get to where I am today and to receive much deeper benefit from my practice, much deeper benefit from my view and my life, etc. And I wonder how much of that time is just a natural function of the unfolding, the time it takes to practice and go to retreats and to learn and to have things settle, and how much of that was a function of starting with mindfulness, basic mindfulness, and studying in the Vipassana tradition, where the teaching is pretty sparse. It's mostly sit and find out, and at least in the experiences that I had, it wasn't like a lot of teaching and a lot of explanation of the Dharma.
No,
at least for me. And I ask this because when I go to teach today, I am looking for the right balance that will. I'm sure, like, if I go too deep, it maybe won't help others and maybe even push them away. And if I go too shallow, maybe I will repeat the same sort of process that I went through. So I'm curious how you view this.
Yeah.
Like what, where to start or what is appropriate in your eyes.
Well, I'm curious. What did Ulla say? What's your summary, if you wish? Just curious. I'll talk to her later and I'll ask her. All right. I don't want to put you under pressure.
No. I can share. The way I remember it is she shared. I think she used very personal and beautiful language to describe maybe higher teachings without using any like Dharma terms, and she was, I think, showcasing how it is possible to talk about the Dharma in a way that is available and open to others.
Yeah,
that's sort of the impression that I got from
her.
I don't. I didn't feel like she answered this question. More like she just showed how it's possible to do both. Maybe.
The priority, as we've spoken this morning, is the sharing and the offering which can be made. And with that, there are two things. One is, for some, it may well be grounded in a mindfulness experience, teaching, accompanied with meditation, for sure. That can then develop through lots of exposure, very specifically to teachings, to retreats, nature, reflections, listening, learning. So there is some expanse in the being of the heart, really sound development of the mind, which is critically important. It's a development of the mind as much as the heart. And out of that, there is a kind of evolution into, we might call it, Dharma teaching. One can never go too deep. And that's the postman. One can never go... One can never go too deep. And with that, with the depth, it, in the sharing of some depth, the voice of the sharing, it might mean those who listen, it goes straight over their head, or it just goes intellectual. So if one starts teaching about liberation, teaching about profound realizations, teaching about the emptiness of I and my, teachings about the immeasurable, about reality and more, whoa, these are major themes. This is deep. And it requires the insight and the understanding of the of that which is deep to be able to share. Otherwise it's going to sound theoretical, metaphysical, and it will be an immensely useful sleeping tablet for people rather than waking them up. So for some, like I said, it is gradual, and to trust in the gradual. But for others, it can be sudden. There genuinely can be sudden realizations that touch something so deep, and it could be that the language emerges out of it as well. So the tradition has discussed and recognized and acknowledged sudden transformation and gradual. There's whole school, you will know, there's whole schools about this dialogue. Many conversations with the monks, with the teacher, was on this sudden and gradual there. So let's be really available to both. And so all your good practices will serve you, serve others. Keep the sense of development and expansiveness alive. Keep your interest in the teachings, because as you point out, sometimes on retreats the emphasis is so much on the silence and the receptivity, and maybe just one talk a day or whatever. But to make good use of the teachings, there's obviously plenty around, and online and so forth. So that's giving nourishment. But make sure you don't breathe in so much, you're not breathing out. Otherwise, you'll end up as a Buddhologist. and frankly, there are too many around already. So experience is what catches people, what people feel, wow, this person has some experience. And it's easier to listen to. Theory is, oh. All right, great to talk to you. Thank you. So should we just have a quiet minute together, or is there another voice that would like to speak?
Christopher?
Yes, hi.
I wanted to ask about challenging situations.
Yes.
As the teacher.
Yes.
Experience. You have many years of experience, so yes. Maybe you haven't come across a challenging situation, but
I wish I could say yes. Not the case. Go on. Plenty of
them. Yes. So good. So I'm happy to hear that, yes.
Good. I wasn't always so happy to hear it at the time, but afterwards.
Exactly.
All right, go on.
So I'm curious how, from your experience and with the much learning in as the teacher, how you've handled certain things, whether it's someone that's very destructive in the meditation, or issues with participants between each other, or I'm telling you things about things that I've encountered also recently, some very emotional people that might be a bit also unstable, and how what might be a wise approach, and a learning as well, using that situation.
Yeah.
So that's my main question.
It's a really important one. Just on the detail for the moment, around 20 years ago, three of us, that's Subhana, who's a senior teacher in Australia, and also Vipassana teacher, Zen teacher, psychotherapist, and then Mark Coleman, who's English but lives in the US, also I think psychologist, counselor, senior teacher now these days, we put together under the general heading of how to respond in a spiritual emergency, and practical down-to-earth tips and advice in addressing exactly those things which you just referred to. So you might take a look at that. And so you just go to Christopher Titmus blog, and then you see find, you could put in spiritual emergency. And in fact, I just went through it again and just refined it and checked with Mark and Subhana. It was okay still. I tightened it up a little bit. And it's in this year, I think. But spiritual emergency, you'll see in the find, and then that will tell you, that will be helpful, and for others as well there. Just on the issues, everything from complete psychological breakdown, massive crisis with health issue, people who really very, very disruptive. They're angry, they're confused, they're talking all the time, and much more. And this used to particularly happen in India, on the India retreats, and even more so in the 70s, 80s, into the 90s, because people coming to the retreats completely stoned out of their brain cells. They're in India, and they've been on medication, they turn up on the retreat, and they they stop their medication because meditation is going to replace medication, and of course they lose the plot, and Christopher's got to deal with it, and so all this, God, I can tell you some dramas. Anyway, we won't go into all of that. Firstly, I doubt if the teacher can do it alone, if you've got a large group of people. So I would have 2 or 3, 4 people who would, I would ask to be supportive. So sometimes I'd be really concerned about a person. She or he would come up to me and say, I'm suicidal. I've been thinking of it for months. I can't get it out of my head. Perhaps a retreat, but it's still going on inside of me. There, and then the person pulls their sleeve up and shows me the cuts on their wrists that they did a year ago. Whoa, 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 whoa. So then I would have a person. I used to call them CIA, you know, like the American Contemplatives in Action. CIA. I'd say, your job on this retreat as a good friend to this person and to me, you keep your eye on this person. I can't. I've got 100 other people to work with. So I'd have people around. Some people very good with their empathy skills. Checking with this person. You got my okay to talk with this person. So not putting all the burden on myself because of there, and that person would come and check with me there, and sometimes on the night hours in the night I'd be on the duty. On the duty is when the person is walking around the grounds shouting and screaming their head off at 3 o'clock in the morning. When somebody's banging on my door and they projected themselves as a bull. And they're charging around as a bully. Whoa, whoa, people getting. But one person, she, in this case, she thought she was the Buddha and I was her disciple. That was another whole mindset to have to deal with, etc. But the power of the friendship, the kindness, the sharing, keeping the flow of communication going, a good small team of CIA, and taking care of as much as we could after the retreat. It's a challenge, this business. But do have a look at what we wrote. Be helpful. Yeah, kindness, empathy, clarity. I would take them regularly out of the form. So not saying you must sit and walk and you've got to work through it. Might encourage the person to do gardening, to do cleaning work. Sometimes I would be checking in with the person for 10 minutes, once, twice, 3 or 4 times a day. If they were in crisis in the night, okay, come and knock on the door, we'd have to talk. We're here to give support, and we need, as I say, 2 or 3 others who can also as well. Then it works. It's much, much less these days, but there's always a few around. And they sometimes, we had one person with a bit of a breakdown a few years ago, and she didn't, we have a form, particularly for India, where people fill out a form. Have you had any mental health issues? Are you on medication? Do you have any trauma? And it's completely confidential. And the managers don't see it. Only the teacher sees it. And it's stated, only the teacher will see this as a separate form. And this person said no, 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 and only had come out of a mental hospital 2 months ago. And said no, and then started to kind of quote unquote fall apart there. It all worked out okay, And I said, but why didn't you just let me know? Just, it's completely confidential, just these few points, you know, that we ask, half a dozen questions. She said she thought, if I filled it in, you wouldn't permit me to come on the retreat. And that, things like that happen. I've never yet stopped anybody from being on a retreat, even though I've thought about it. Yeah, sometimes it's a different kind of retreat. We're in the business of dealing with suffering. But other teachers on this point, it's the same message to them, should not feel pressure to be able to accommodate everybody. That's asking too much of many, many teachers. You know, teachers need to know their, in a way, their limits. Need to know in themselves who or what they can accommodate in terms of persons there. And that's, I think, really, really important, because it'd be really unfortunate the teacher starts to worry, feeling stress. You know, someone says they're feeling suicidal, the teacher's, so we've got to know who we can accommodate, who we can work with, and to be, you know, quietly clear about that. And some of us, my general concept, I, in a very affectionate way, I call them the crazies, you know, in a very affectionate way, because I think the world is crazy and life is crazy, and sometimes in this crazy world, the quote-unquote crazy will come. But sometimes it can really, it really, really works well. Sometimes a person just needs someone who accepts them and loves them and gives them lots of support, and they're fine. You know, so those challenges will come. Usually it's awkward people, argumentative people, and people who want to chat all the time. So it takes a little skill with them too. Right? But have a look at the blog. And if you've got any further questions, you could always email me as well. We could talk a little bit more. All right, thank you. All right, everyone. Ula said, I heard her say at the beginning, it's only for 90 minutes, it's not for 2 hours. So we better keep to the good advice of our motherly guru here. I'm going to have a 2 minute sharing just to finish. So just sitting. Just resting in the stillness. So there is a closure, in a way, of our interactive time together over the last hour plus. So in our interactive periods, if we can find, as we are doing right now, some quiet moments. A and return into the stillness and the silence for the renewal for our next interactive period. So our daily life is an engagement and being, and from being into engagement, and engagement back to being. Not making one more important than the other. Not thinking that the time should be equal for both. And keeping our heart, mind, and ears, eyes open, a receptivity in which teachings support practice and application. Application and practices support receptivity to further teachings. Too much of the teachings, it starts to become rather mental, theoretical, logical. Absence of receptivity to the teachings, the practices become rather mechanical, habitual, repetitive. Both are mutually supportive and mutually nourishing. In the same way as being and engaging. May all beings live with wise attention. May all beings explore teachings, practices, application. May all beings abide with a liberating wisdom.